did me. The teacher praised me first, with moderation, and then went on to exalt her prowess. I felt the poison of defeat more acutely when it was Sartore or Peluso who did better than me. If, however, I came in second after Leela, I wore a meek expression of acquiescence. In those years, I think I feared only one thing, not being paired in the hierarchy established by Maestro Oliviero with Leela, not to hear the teacher say proudly, Cerullo and Greco are the best. If one day she had said, the best are Cerullo and Sartore, or Cerullo and Peluso, I would have died on the spot. So I used all my childish energies not to become first in the class, it seemed to me impossible to succeed there, but not to slip into third, fourth, last place. I devoted myself to studying and to many things that were difficult, alien to me, just so I could keep pace with that terrible, dazzling girl. Dazzling to me. To our classmates, Leela was only terrible. From first grade to fifth, she was, because of the principal and partly also because of Maestro Oliviero, the most hated child in the school and the neighborhood. At least twice a year, the principal had the classes compete against one another, in order to distinguish the most brilliant students and consequently the most competent teachers. Oliviero liked this competition. Our teacher, in permanent conflict with her colleagues, with whom she sometimes seemed near coming to blows, used Leela and me as the blazing proof of how good she was, the best teacher in the neighborhood elementary school. So she would often bring us to other classes, apart from the occasions arranged by the principal, to compete with the other children, girls and boys. Usually, I was sent on reconnaissance to test the enemy's level of skill. In general, I won, but without overdoing it, without humiliating either teachers or students. I was a pretty little girl with blonde curls, happy to show off, but not aggressive, and I gave an impression of delicacy that was touching. If then I was the best at reciting poems, repeating the times tables, doing division and multiplication, at rattling off the Maritime, Cottian, Graia, and Pennine Alps, the other teachers gave me a pat anyway, while the students felt how hard I had worked to memorize all those facts and didn't hate me. In Lila's case, it was different. Even by first grade, she was beyond any possible competition. In fact, the teacher said that with a little application, she would be able to take the test for second grade and, not yet seven, go into third. Later, the gap increased. Lila did really complicated calculations in her head. In her dictations, there was not a single mistake. She spoke in dialect like the rest of us, but, when necessary, came out with a bookish Italian, using words like accustomed, luxuriant, willingly. So that, when the teacher sent her into the field to give the moods or tenses of verbs or solve math problems, hearts grew bitter. Leela was too much for anyone. Besides, she offered no openings to kindness. To recognize her virtuosity was for us children to admit that we would never win, and so there was no point in competing, and for the teachers to confess to themselves that they had been mediocre children. Her quickness of mind was like a hiss, a dart, a lethal bite. And there was nothing in her appearance that acted as a corrective. She was disheveled, dirty. On her knees and elbows, she always had scabs from cuts and scrapes that never had time to heal. Her large, bright eyes could become cracks behind which, before every brilliant response, there was a gaze that appeared not very childlike, and perhaps not even human. Every one of her movements said that to harm her would be pointless, because whatever happened, she would find a way of doing worse to you. The hatred was therefore tangible. I was aware of it. Both girls and boys were irritated by her, but the boys more openly. For a hidden motive of her own, in fact, Maestro Oliviero especially enjoyed taking us to the classes where the girl students and women teachers could not be humiliated so much as the males. And the principal, too, for equally hidden motives, preferred competitions of this type. Later, I thought that in the school they were betting money, maybe even a lot, on those meetings of ours. But I was exaggerating. Maybe it was just a way of giving vent to old grudges, or allowing the principal to keep the less good or less obedient teachers under his control. The fact is that one morning the two of us, who were then in second grade, were taken to a fourth grade class, Maestro Ferraro's, in which were both Enzo Scano, the fierce son of the fruit and vegetable seller, and Nino Saratore, Marisa's brother, whom I loved. Everyone knew Enzo. He was a repeater, and at least a couple of times had been dragged through the classrooms with a card around his neck, on which Maestro Ferraro, a tall, very thin man, with very short gray hair, a small lined face and worried eyes, had written, "Dunce." Nino, on the other hand, was so good, so meek, so quiet, that he was well known and liked, especially by me. Naturally, Enzo hardly counted, scholastically speaking. We kept an eye on him, only because he was aggressive. Our adversaries, in matters of intelligence, were Nino and, we discovered just then, Alfonso Caracci, the third child of Don Achille, a very neat boy who was in second grade like us, but looked younger than his 7 years. It was clear that the teacher had brought him there to the fourth grade class because he had more faith in him than in Nino, who was almost 2 years older. There was some tension between Oliviero and Ferraro because of that unexpected summoning of Caracci. Then the competition began in front of the two classes assembled in one classroom. They asked us verbs. They asked us times tables. They asked us addition, subtraction, multiplication, division, the four operations. First at the blackboard, then in our heads. Of that particular occasion, I remember three things. The first is that little Alfonso Caracci defeated me immediately. He was calm and precise, but he had the quality of not gloating. The second is that Nino Saratore, surprisingly, almost never answered the questions, but appeared dazed, as if he didn't understand what the teachers were asking him. The third is that Lila stood up to the son of Don Achille reluctantly, as if she didn't care if he beat her. The scene grew lively only when they began to do calculations in their heads, addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division. Alfonso, despite Lila's reluctance and, at times, silence, as if she hadn't heard the question, began to slip, making mistakes especially in multiplication and division. On the other hand, if the son of Don Achille failed, Lila wasn't up to it either, and so they seemed more or less equal. But at a certain point, something unexpected happened. At least twice, when Lila didn't answer, or Alfonso made a mistake, the voice of Enzo Scano, filled with contempt, was heard from a desk at the back, giving the right answer. This astonished the class, the teachers, the principal, me and Lila. How was it possible that someone like Enzo, who was lazy, incapable, and delinquent, could do complicated calculations in his head better than me, than Alfonso Caracci, the Nino Saratore? Suddenly, Lila seemed to wake up. Alfonso was quickly out of the running, and, with the proud consent of Ferraro, who quickly exchanged champions, a duel began between Lila and Enzo. The two competed for a long time. The principal, Going over Ferraro's head, called the son of the fruit and vegetable seller to the front of the room, next to Leela. Enzo left the back row amid uneasy laughter, his own and his friend's, and positioned himself, sullen and uneasy, next to the blackboard, opposite Leela. The duel continued, as they did increasingly difficult calculations in their heads. The boy gave his answers in dialect, as if he were on the street, not in a classroom. And Ferraro corrected his diction, but the figure was always correct. Enzo seemed extremely proud of that moment of glory, amazed himself at how clever he was. Then he began to slip, because Leela had woken up conclusively, and now her eyes had narrowed in determination, and she answered correctly. In the end, Enzo lost. He lost, but was not resigned. He began to curse, to shout ugly obscenities. Ferraro sent him to kneel behind the blackboard, but he wouldn't go. He was wrapped on the knuckles with the rod, and then pulled by the ears to the punishment corner. The school day ended like that. But from then on, the gang of boys began to throw rocks at us. 9. That morning of the duel between Enzo and Leela is important in our long story. Many modes of behavior started off there that were difficult to decipher. For example, it became very clear that Leela could, if she wanted, ration the use of her abilities. That was what she had done with Don Achille's son. She did not want to beat him, but she had also calibrated silences and answers in such a way as not to be beaten. We had not yet become friends, and I couldn't ask her why she had behaved like that. But really, there was no need to ask questions. I could guess the reason. Like me, she too had been forbidden to offend not only Don Achille, but also his family. It was like that. We didn't know the origin of that fear, rancor, hatred, meekness that our parents displayed toward the Karachis and transmitted to us, but it was there. It was a fact. Like the neighborhood, its dirty white houses, the fetid odor of the landings, the dust of the streets. In all likelihood, Nino Saratore, too, had been silent in order to allow Alfonso to be at his best. Handsome, slender, and nervous, with long lashes, hair neatly combed, he had stammered only a few words and had finally been silent. To continue to love him, I wanted to think that was what it had been. But deep down, I had some doubts. Had it been a choice, like Leela's? I wasn't sure. I had stepped aside because Alfonso really was better than me. Leela could have defeated him immediately. Yet she had chosen to aim for a tie. And Nino? There was something that confused and perhaps saddened me. Not an inability, not even surrender, but I would say today, a collapse. That stammer, the pallor, the purple that had suddenly swallowed his eyes. How handsome he was, so languid. And yet how much I disliked his languor. Leela, too, at a certain point, had seemed very beautiful to me. In general, I was the pretty one, while she was skinny, like a salted anchovy. She gave off an odor of wildness. She had a long face, narrow at the temples, framed by two bands of smooth black hair. But when she decided to vanquish both Alfonso and Enzo, she had lighted up like a holy warrior. Her cheeks flushed, the sign of a flame released by every corner of her body. And for the first time I thought, Leela is prettier than I am. So I was second in everything. I hoped that no one would ever realize it. But the most important thing that morning was the discovery that a phrase we often used to avoid punishment contained something true, hence uncontrollable, hence dangerous. The formula was, I didn't do it on purpose. Enzo, in fact, had not entered the competition deliberately and had not deliberately beaten Alfonso. Leela had deliberately defeated Enzo, but had not deliberately defeated Alfonso, or deliberately humiliated him. It had been only a necessary step. The conclusion we drew from this convinced us that it was best to do everything on purpose, deliberately, so that you would know what to expect. Because almost nothing had been done deliberately, many unforeseen things struck us, one after the other. Alfonso went home in tears as a result of his defeat. His brother, Stefano, who was 14, an apprentice in the grocery store, the former workshop of the carpenter Peluso, owned by his father, who, however, never set foot in it, showed up outside school the next day and said very nasty things to Leela, to the point of threatening her. She yelled an obscenity at him, and he pushed her against a wall and tried to grab her tongue, shouting that he would prick it with a pin. Leela went home and told her brother Rino everything, and the more she talked, the redder he got, his eyes bright. In the meantime, Enzo, going home one night without his country gang, was stopped by Stefano and punched and kicked. Rino, in the morning, went to look for Stefano, and they had a fight, giving each other a more or less equal beating. A few days later, the wife of Don Achille, Donna Maria, knocked on the Cerullo's door and made a scene with Nunzia, shouting and insulting her. A little time passed, and one Sunday, after Mass, Fernando Cerullo, the shoemaker, the father of Leela and Rino, a small thin man, timidly accosted Don Achille and apologized, without ever saying what he was apologizing for. I didn't see it, or at least I don't remember it. But it was said that the apologies were made aloud, and in such a way that everyone could hear, even though Don Achille had walked by as if the shoemaker were not speaking to him. Sometime later, Leela and I wounded Enzo in the calf with a stone, and Enzo threw a stone that hit Leela in the head. While I was shrieking in fear, and Leela got up with the blood dripping from under her hair, Enzo, who was also bleeding, climbed down the embankment, and, seeing Leela in that state, he utterly, unpredictably, and to our eyes incomprehensibly, began to cry. Then Rino, Leela's adored brother, came to school, and, outside, beat up Enzo, who barely defended himself. Rino was older, bigger, and more motivated. Not only that, Enzo didn't mention that beating to his gang, or his mother, or his father, or his brothers, or his cousins, who all worked in the countryside and sold fruit and vegetables from a cart. At that point, thanks to him, the feuds ended. 10. Leela went around proudly for a while, with her head bandaged. Then she took off the bandage and showed anyone who asked the black scar, red at the edges, that stuck out on her forehead under the hairline. Finally, people forgot what had happened, and if someone stared at the whitish mark left on her skin, she made an aggressive gesture that meant, "What are you looking at? Mind your own business." To me, she never said anything. Not even a word of thanks for the rocks I had handed her, for how I had dried the blood with the edge of my smock. But from that moment, she began to subject me to proofs of courage that had nothing to do with school. We saw each other in the courtyard more and more frequently. We showed off our dolls to each other, but without appearing to, one in the other's vicinity, as if each of us were alone. At some point, we let the dolls meet, as a test, to see if they got along. And so came the day when we sat next to the cellar window with the curled grating and exchanged our dolls. She holding mine, and I hers. And Leela abruptly pushed Tina through the opening in the grating and dropped her. I felt an unbearable sorrow. I was attached to my plastic doll. It was the most precious possession I had. I knew that Leela was mean, but I had never expected her to do something so spiteful to me. For me, the doll was alive. To know that she was on the floor of the cellar amid the thousand beasts that lived there threw me into despair. But that day I learned a skill at which I later excelled. I held back my despair. I held it back on the edge of my wet tears so that Leela said to me in dialect, "You don't care about her?" I didn't answer. I felt a violent pain. But I sensed that the pain of quarreling with her would be even stronger. I was as if strangled by two agonies, one already happening, the loss of the doll, and one possible, the loss of Leela. I said nothing. I only acted without spite, as if it were natural, even if it wasn't natural, and I knew I was taking a great risk. I merely threw into the cellar her new, the doll she had just given me. Leela looked at me in disbelief. "What you do, I do," I recited immediately, aloud, very frightened. "Now go and get it for me." "If you go and get mine." We went together. At the entrance to the building, on the left, was the door that led to the cellars. We knew it well. Because it was broken, one of the panels was hanging on just one hinge. The entrance was blocked by a chain that crudely held the two panels together. Every child was tempted, and at the same time terrified by the possibility of forcing the door that little bit that would make it possible to go through to the other side. We did it. We made a space wide enough for our slender, supple bodies to slip through into the cellar. Once inside, we descended, Leela in the lead, 5 stone steps into a damp space, dimly lit by the narrow openings at street level. I was afraid and tried to stay close behind Leela, but she seemed angry and intent on finding her doll. I groped my way forward. I felt under the soles of my sandals objects that squeaked, glass, gravel, insects. All around were things not identifiable, dark masses, sharp or square or rounded. The faint light that pierced the darkness sometimes fell on something recognizable, the skeleton of a chair, the pole of a lamp, fruit boxes, the bottoms and sides of wardrobes, iron hinges. I got scared by what seemed to me a soft face with large glass eyes that lengthened into a chin shaped like a box. I saw it hanging with its desolate expression on a rickety wooden stand, and I cried out to Leela, pointing to it. She turned and slowly approached it with her back to me, carefully extended one hand, and detached it from the stand. Then she turned around. She had put the face with the glass eyes over hers, and now her face was enormous, with round, empty eye sockets and no mouth, only that protruding black chain swinging over her chest. Those are moments which are stamped into memory. I'm not sure, but I must have let out a cry of real terror, because she hurried to say in an echoing voice that it was just a mask. An anti-gas mask. That's what her father called it. He had one like it in the storeroom at home. I continued to tremble and moan with fear, which evidently persuaded her to tear the thing off her face and throw it in a corner, causing a loud noise and a lot of dust that thickened amid the tongues of light from the windows. I calmed down. Leela looked around, identified the opening from which we had dropped Tina and New. We went along the rough, bumpy wall. We looked into the shadows. The dolls weren't there. Leela repeated in dialect, "They're not there. They're not there. They're not there," and searched along the floor with her hands, something I didn't have the courage to do. Long minutes passed. Once only I seemed to see Tina, and with a tug at my heart I bent over to grab her, but it was only a crumpled page of old newspaper. "They aren't here," Leela repeated, and headed toward the door. Then I felt lost, unable to stay there by myself and keep searching, unable to leave if I hadn't found my doll. At the top of the steps, she said, "Don Achille took them. He put them in his black bag." And at that very moment, I heard him. Don Achille. He slithered. He shuffled among the indistinct shapes of things. Then I abandoned Tina to her fate and ran away in order not to lose Leela, who was already twisting nimbly between the panels of the broken door. 11. I believed everything she told me. The shapeless mass of Don Achille running through the underground tunnels, arms dangling, large fingers grasping New's head in one hand, in the other Tina's. I suffered terribly. I got sick, had fevers, got better, got sick again. I was overcome by a kind of tactile dysfunction. Sometimes I had the impression that, while every animated being around me was speeding up the rhythms of its life, solid surfaces turned soft under my fingers or swelled up, leaving empty spaces between their internal mass and the surface skin. It seemed to me that my own body, if you touched it, was distended, and this saddened me. I was sure that I had cheeks like balloons, hands stuffed with sawdust, earlobes like ripe berries, feet in the shape of loaves of bread. When I returned to the streets and to school, I felt that the space too had changed. It seemed to be chained between two dark poles. On one side was the underground air bubble that pressed on the roots of the houses, the threatening cavern the dolls had fallen into. On the other, the upper sphere, on the fourth floor of the building where Don Achille, who had stolen them, lived. The two balls were as if screwed to the ends of an iron bar, which in my imagination obliquely crossed the apartments, the streets, the countryside, the tunnel, the railroad tracks, and compressed them. I felt squeezed in that vice along with the mass of everyday things and people. And I had a bad taste in my mouth, a permanent sense of nausea that exhausted me, as if everything, thus compacted and always tighter, were grinding me up, reducing me to a repulsive cream. It was an enduring malaise, lasting perhaps years, beyond early adolescence. But unexpectedly, just when it began, I received my first declaration of love. It was before Leela and I had attempted to climb the stairs to Don Achille's, and my grief at the loss of Tina was still unbearable. I had gone reluctantly to buy bread. My mother had sent me, and I was going home, the change clutched in my fist and the loaf still warm against my chest, when I realized that Nino Saratore was trudging behind me, holding his little brother by the hand. On summer days, his mother Lydia always sent him out with Pino, who at the time was no more than 5, with the injunction never to leave him. Near a corner, a little past the Carracci's grocery, Nino was about to pass me. But instead of passing, he cut off my path, pushed me against the wall, placed his free hand against the wall as a bar to keep me from running away, and with the other, pulled up beside him his brother, a silent witness of his undertaking. Breathlessly, he said something I couldn't understand. He was pale, and he smiled. Then he became serious. Then he smiled again. Finally, he said, in school Italian, "When we grow up, I want to marry you." Then he asked me if in the meantime I would be engaged to him. He was a little taller than me, very thin, with a long neck, his ears sticking out a little from his head. He had rebellious hair and intense eyes with long lashes. The effort he was making to restrain his timidity was touching. Although I also wanted to marry him, I felt like answering, "No, I can't." He was stunned. Pino gave him a tug. I ran away. From that moment, I began to sneak into a side street whenever I saw him. And yet, he seemed to me so handsome. How many times had I hung around his sister Marisa just to be near him, and walk part of the way home with them? But he had made the declaration at the wrong moment. He couldn't know how undone I felt, how much anguish Tina's disappearance had caused me, how exhausting the effort of keeping up with Leela was, how the compressed space of the courtyard, the buildings, the neighborhood cut off my breath. After giving me many long, frightened glances from a distance, he began to avoid me too. For a while, he must have been afraid that I would tell the other girls, and in particular his sister, about the proposal he had made. Everyone knew that Giliola Spagnuolo, the daughter of the baker, had done that when Enzo had asked her to be his girlfriend. And Enzo had found out and got angry. He had shouted outside school that she was a liar. He had even threatened to kill her with a knife. I too was tempted to tell everything, but then I let it go. I didn't tell anyone, not even Leela when we became friends. Slowly, I forgot about it myself. It came to my mind again when, sometime later, the entire Saratore family moved. One morning, the cart and horse that belonged to Assunta's husband, Nicola, appeared in the courtyard. With that same cart and the same old horse, he sold fruit and vegetables with his wife, going up and down the streets of the neighborhood. Nicola had a broad, handsome face and the same blue eyes, the same blonde hair as his son Enzo. Besides selling fruit and vegetables, he was the mover. And in fact, he, Donato Saratore, Nino himself, and Lydia too, began to carry things downstairs, all sorts of odds and ends, mattresses, furniture, and piled it on the cart. As soon as the women heard the sound of wheels in the courtyard, they looked out, including my mother, including me. There was a great curiosity. It seemed that Donato had got a new house directly from the state railroad, in the neighborhood of a square called Piazza Nazionale. Or, said my mother, his wife had obliged him to move to escape the persecutions of Melina, who wanted to take away her husband. Likely. My mother always saw evil, where, to my great annoyance, it was sooner or later discovered that evil really was. And her crossed eye seemed made purposely to identify the secret motives of the neighborhood. How would Melina react? Was it true, as I had heard whispered, that she had had a child with Saratore and then killed it? And was it possible that she would start shouting terrible things, including that? All the females, big and small, were at the windows, perhaps to wave goodbye to the family that was leaving, perhaps to witness the spectacle of rage of that ugly, lean, and widowed woman. I saw that Leela and her mother Nunzia were also watching. I sought Nino's gaze, but he seemed to have other things to do. I was then seized, as usual for no precise reason, by a weariness that made everything around me faint. I thought that perhaps he had made that declaration because he already knew that he would be leaving and wanted to tell me first what he felt for me. I looked at him as he struggled to carry boxes filled to overflowing, and I felt the guilt, the sorrow of having said no. Now he was fleeing like a bird. Finally, the procession of furniture and household goods stopped. Nicola and Donato began to tie everything to the cart with ropes. Lydia Saratore appeared dressed as if to go to a party. She had even put on a summer hat of blue straw. She pushed the carriage with her youngest boy in it, and beside her she had the two girls, Marissa, who was my age, 8 or 9, and Clelia, 6. Suddenly, there was a noise of things breaking on the second floor. Almost at the same moment, Melina began screaming. Her cries were so tortured that Lila, I saw, put her hands over her ears. The pained voice of Ada, Melina's second child, echoed as she cried, "Mama! No, Mama!" After a moment of uncertainty, I too covered my ears. But meanwhile, objects began to fly out the window, and curiosity became so strong that I freed my eardrums, as if I needed clear sounds to understand. Melina, however, wasn't uttering words, but only, "Ah, ah," as if she were wounded. She couldn't be seen. Not even an arm or a hand that was throwing things could be seen. Copper pots, glasses, bottles, plates appeared to fly out the window of their own volition. And in the street, Lydia Saratore walked with her head down, leaning over the baby carriage, her daughters behind, while Donato climbed up on the cart amid his property, and Don Nicola guided the horse by the bridle, and meanwhile objects hit the asphalt, bounced, shattered, sending splinters between the nervous hooves of the beast. I looked at Lila. Now I saw another face, a face of bewilderment. She must have realized that I was looking at her, and she immediately disappeared from the window. Meanwhile, the cart started off, keeping to the wall, without a goodbye to anyone. Lydia and the four youngest children slunk toward the gate, while Nino seemed unwilling to leave, as if hypnotized by the waste of fragile objects against the asphalt. Last I saw flying out the window a sort of black spot. It was an iron, pure steel. When I still had Tina and played in the house, I used my mother's, which was identical, prow-shaped, pretending it was a ship in a storm. The object plummeted down and with a sharp thud made a hole in the ground, a few inches from Nino. It nearly, very nearly, killed him. 12. No boy ever declared to Lila that he loved her, and she never told me if it grieved her. Giliola Spagnuolo received proposals to be someone's girlfriend continuously, and I too was much in demand. Lila, on the other hand, wasn't popular, mostly because she was skinny, dirty, and always had a cut or bruise of some sort, but also because she had a sharp tongue. She invented humiliating nicknames, and although in front of the teacher she showed off Italian words that no one knew, with us, she spoke a scathing dialect, full of swear words, which cut off at its origin any feeling of love. Only Enzo did a thing that, if it wasn't exactly a request to be her boyfriend, was nevertheless a sign of admiration and respect. Sometime after he had cut her head with the rock, and before, it seems to me, he was rejected by Giliola Spagnuolo, he ran into us on the stradone, and, before my incredulous eyes, held out to Lila a garland of sorb apples. "What do I do with it?" "You eat them." "Bitter?" "Let them ripen." "I don't want them." throw them away. That was it. Enzo turned his back and hurried off to work. Leela and I started laughing. We didn't talk much, but we had a laugh at everything that happened to us. I said only, in a tone of amusement, "I like sorb apples." I was lying. It was a fruit I didn't like. I was attracted by their reddish-yellow color when they were unripe, their compactness that gleamed on sunny days. But when they ripened on the balconies and became brown and soft like small wrinkled pears, and the skin came off easily, displaying a grainy pulp, not with a bad taste, but spongy in a way that reminded me of the corpses of rats along the Stradone, then I wouldn't even touch them. I made that statement almost as a test, hoping that Leela would offer them to me. "Here, take them, you have them." I felt that if she had given me the gift that Enzo had given her, I would be happier than if she had given me something of hers. But she didn't, and I still recall the feeling of betrayal when she brought them home. She herself put a nail at the window. I saw her hang the garland on it. 13. Enzo didn't give her any other gifts. After the fight with Giliola, who had told everyone about the declaration he had made to her, we saw him less and less. Although he had proved to be extremely good at doing sums in his head, he was lazy. So the teacher didn't suggest that he take the admissions test for the middle school, and he wasn't sorry about it. In fact, he was pleased. He enrolled in the trade school, but in fact he was already working with his parents. He got up very early to go with his father to the fruit and vegetable market, or to drive the cart through the neighborhood, selling produce from the countryside, and so he soon quit school. We, instead, toward the end of fifth grade, were told that it would be suitable for us to continue in school. The teacher summoned in turn my parents, and those of Giliola and Leela, to tell them that we absolutely had to take not only the test for the elementary school diploma, but also the one for admission to middle school. I did all I could so that my father would not send my mother, with her limp, her wandering eye, and her stubborn anger, but would go himself, since he was a porter and knew how to be polite. I didn't succeed. She went, she talked to the teacher, and returned home in a sullen mood. The teacher wants money. She says she has to give some extra lessons because the test is difficult. "But what's the point of this test?" my father asked. "To let her study Latin." "Why?" "Because they say she's clever." "But if she's clever, why does the teacher have to give her lessons that cost money?" "So she'll be better off and we'll be worse." They discussed it at length. At first, my mother was against it, and my father uncertain. Then my father became cautiously in favor, and my mother resigned herself to being a little less against it. Finally, they decided to let me take the test, but always provided that if I did not do well, they would immediately take me out of school. Leela's parents, on the other hand, said no. Nunzia Cerullo made a few somewhat hesitant attempts, but her father wouldn't even talk about it. And in fact, hit Reno when he told him that he was wrong. Her parents were inclined not to go and see the teacher, but Maestra Oliviero had the principal summon them, and then Nunzia had to go. Faced with the timid but flat refusal of that frightened woman, Maestra Oliviero, stern but calm, displayed Leela's marvelous compositions, the brilliant solutions to difficult problems, and even the beautifully colored drawings that in class, when she applied herself, enchanted us all. Because, pilfering Giotto's pastels, she portrayed in a realistic style princesses with hairdos, jewels, clothes, shoes that had never been seen in any book or even at the parish cinema. When the refusal persisted, the teacher lost her composure and dragged Leela's mother to the principal as if she were a student to be disciplined. But Nunzia couldn't yield. She didn't have permission from her husband. As a result, she kept saying no until she, the teacher, and the principal were overcome by exhaustion. The next day, as we were going to school, Leela said to me in her usual tone, "I'm going to take the test anyway." I believed her. To forbid her to do something was pointless. Everyone knew it. She seemed the strongest of us girls, stronger than Enzo, than Alfonso, than Stefano, stronger than her brother Rino, stronger than our parents, stronger than all the adults, including the teacher and the carabinieri, who could put you in jail. Although she was fragile in appearance, every prohibition lost substance in her presence. She knew how to go beyond the limit without ever truly suffering the consequences. In the end, people gave in, and were even, however unwillingly, compelled to praise her. 14. We were also forbidden to go to Don Aquiles, but she decided to go anyway, and I followed. In fact, that was when I became convinced that nothing could stop her, and that every disobedient act contained breathtaking opportunities. We wanted Don Aquile to give us back our dolls, so we climbed the stairs. At every step, I was on the point of turning around and going back to the courtyard. I still feel Leela's hand grasping mine, and I like to think that she decided to take it not only because she intuited that I wouldn't have the courage to get to the top floor, but also because with that gesture, she herself sought the force to continue. So, one beside the other, I on the wall side and she on the banister side, sweaty palms clasped, we climbed the last flights. At Don Aquile's door, my heart was pounding. I could hear it in my ears. But I was consoled by thinking that it was also the sound of Leela's heart. From the apartment came voices, perhaps of Alfonso, or Stefano, or Pinuccia. After a very long, silent pause before the door, Leela rang the bell. There was silence, then a shuffling. Donna Maria opened the door, wearing a faded green house dress. When she spoke, I saw a brilliant gold tooth in her mouth. She thought we were looking for Alfonso and was a bit bewildered. Leela said to her in dialect, "No, we want Don Aquile." "Tell me. We have to speak to him." The woman shouted, "Aquí!" More shuffling. A thick-set figure emerged from the shadows. He had a long torso, short legs, arms that hung to his knees, and a cigarette in his mouth. You could see the embers. He asked hoarsely, "Who is it?" "The daughter of the shoemaker, with Greco's oldest daughter." Don Aquile came into the light, and for the first time, we saw him clearly. No minerals, no sparkle of glass. His long face was of flesh, and the hair bristled only around his ears. The top of his head was shiny. His eyes were bright, the white veined with small red streams. His mouth wide and thin, his chin heavy, with a crease in the middle. He seemed to me ugly, but not the way I imagined.
"Well?"
"The dolls," said Leela.
"What dolls?"
"Ours."
"Your dolls are of no use here?"
"You took them down in the cellar." Don Aquile turned and shouted into the apartment.
"Pinu, did you take the doll belonging to the shoemaker's daughter?"
"Me? No."
"Alfo, Did you take it?
Laughter. Leela said firmly, I don't know where she got all that courage. You took them. We saw you. There was a moment of silence.
You... me?
Yes, and you put them in your black bag. The man, hearing those words, wrinkled his forehead in annoyance. I couldn't believe that we were here, in front of Don Achille, and Leela was speaking to him like that, and he was staring at her in bewilderment. And in the background could be seen Alfonso and Stefano and Pinuccia and Donna Maria, who was setting the table for dinner. I couldn't believe that he was an ordinary person, a little short, a little bald, a little out of proportion, but ordinary. So I waited for him to be abruptly transformed. Don Achille repeated, as if to understand clearly the meaning of the words, I took your dolls and put them in a black bag? I felt that he was not angry, but unexpectedly pained, as if he were receiving confirmation of something he already knew. He said something in dialect that I didn't understand. Maria cried, Aquí, it's ready.
I'm coming.
Don Achille stuck a large, broad hand in the back pocket of his pants. We clutched each other's hand tightly, waiting for him to bring out a knife. Instead, he took out his wallet, opened it, looked inside, and handed Leela some money. I don't remember how much.
Go buy yourselves dolls, he said.
Leela grabbed the money and dragged me down the stairs. He muttered, leaning over the banister,
And remember that they were a gift from me.
I said, in Italian, careful not to trip on the stairs, Good evening, and enjoy your meal. 15. Right after Easter, Giliola Spagnuolo and I started going to the teacher's house to prepare for the admissions test. The teacher lived right next to the parish church of the Holy Family, and her windows looked out on the public gardens. From there, you could see, beyond the dense countryside, the pylons of the railroad. Giliola passed by my window and called me. I was ready. I ran out. I liked those private lessons. Two a week, I think. The teacher, at the end of the lesson, offered us little heart-shaped cookies and a soft drink. Leela didn't come. Her parents had not agreed to pay the teacher. But, since we were now good friends, she continued to tell me that she would take the test and would enter the first year of middle school in the same class as me. And the books? You'll lend them to me. Meanwhile, however, with the money from Don Achille, she bought a book, Little Women. She decided to buy it because she already knew it and liked it hugely. Maestra Oliviero, in fourth grade, had given the smarter girls books to read. Leela had received Little Women, along with the following comment. This is for older girls, but it will be good for you. And I got the book Heart, by Edmondo De Amicis, with not a word of explanation. Leela read both Little Women and Heart in a very short time, and said there was no comparison. In her opinion, Little Women was wonderful. I hadn't managed to read it. I had had a hard time finishing Heart before the time set by the teacher for returning it. I was a slow reader. I still am. Leela, when she had to give the book back to Maestra Oliviero, regretted both not being able to reread Little Women continuously and not being able to talk about it with me. So one morning she made up her mind. She called me from the street. We went to the ponds, to the place where we had buried the money from Don Achille, in a metal box, took it out, and went to ask Yolanda, the stationer, who had had displayed in her window forever a copy of Little Women, yellowed by the sun, if it was enough. It was. As soon as we became owners of the book, we began to meet in the courtyard to read it, either silently, one next to the other, or aloud. We read it for months, so many times that the book became tattered and sweat-stained. It lost its spine, came unthreaded, sections fell apart. But it was our book. We loved it dearly. I was the guardian. I kept it at home among the school books, because Leela didn't feel she could keep it in her house. Her father, lately, would get angry if she merely took it out to read. But Reno protected her. When the subject of the admissions test came up, quarrels exploded continuously between him and his father. Reno was about 16 at the time. He was a very excitable boy, and had started a battle to be paid for the work he did. His reasoning was, "I get up at 6. I come to the shop and work till 8 at night. I want a salary." But those words outraged his father and his mother. Reno had a bed to sleep in, food to eat. Why did he want money? His job was to help the family, not impoverish it. But he insisted. He found it unjust to work as hard as his father and not receive a cent. At that point, Fernando Cerullo answered him with apparent patience, "I pay you already, Reno. I pay you generously by teaching you the whole trade. Soon you'll be able to repair a heel or an edge or put on a new sole. Your father is passing on to you everything he knows, and you'll be able to make an entire shoe with the skill of a professional." But that payment by instruction was not enough for Reno. And so they argued, especially at dinner. They began by talking about money and ended up quarreling about Leela. "If you pay me, I'll take care of sending her to school," Reno said.
"School? Why? Did I go to school?"
"No."
"Did you go to school?"
"No."
"Then why should your sister, who is a girl, go to school?"
The matter almost always ended with a slap in the face for Reno, who, one way or another, even if he didn't intend to, had displayed a lack of respect toward his father. The boy, without crying, apologized in a spiteful tone of voice. Leela was silent during those discussions. She never said so, but I had the impression that while I hated my mother, really hated her, profoundly, she, in spite of everything, wasn't upset with her father. She said that he was full of kindnesses. She said that when there were accounts to do, he let her do them. She said that she had heard him say to his friends that his daughter was the most intelligent person in the neighborhood. She said that on her name day, he brought her warm chocolate in bed and 4 biscuits. But what could you do? It didn't enter into his view of the world that she should continue to go to school. Nor did it fall within his economic possibilities. The family was large. They all had to live off the shoe repair shop, including 2 unmarried sisters of Fernando and Nunzia's parents. So on the matter of school, it was like talking to the wall, and her mother all in all had the same opinion. Only her brother had different ideas, and fought boldly against his father. And Leela, for reasons I didn't understand, seemed certain that Reno would win. He would get his salary and would send her to school with the money. "If there's a fee to pay, he'll pay it for me," she explained. She was sure that her brother would also give her money for the school books and even for pens, pen case, pastels, globe, the smock and the ribbon. She adored him. She said that, after she went to school, she wanted to earn a lot of money for the sole purpose of making her brother the wealthiest person in the neighborhood. In that last year of elementary school, wealth became our obsession. We talked about it the way characters in novels talk about searching for treasure. We said, when we're rich, we'll do this. We'll do that. To listen to us, you might think that the wealth was hidden